Welcome to this eViral Hepatitis Review Podcast. I'm Bob Busker, managing editor of the program. Our guest today is Dr. Ira Jacobson, director of hepatology at the New York University School of Medicine. And we're here to discuss how the new options for hard-to-treat patients with hepatitis C infection, as he described in his newsletter issue, can translate into clinical practice improvement. eViral Hepatitis Review is jointly presented by the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and the Institute for Johns Hopkins Nursing. This program is supported by educational grants from Gilead Sciences Incorporated, Merck & Company, and AbbVie Incorporated. Learning objectives for this audio program include describe the key clinical considerations when selecting a retreatment regimen for patients who have failed previous therapy with DAA agents. Describe the key clinical considerations when selecting a retreatment regimen for patients who have failed previous therapy with PEG interferon and ribavirin, and describe the key clinical considerations when selecting a treatment regimen for patients with renal impairment. Dr. Jacobson has disclosed that he has served as a consultant and or advisor to AbbVie Incorporated, Bristol Myers Squibb, Gilead Sciences Incorporated, Janssen, Merck & Company, and Trek. His discussion today will mention the unlabeled or unapproved uses of DAA combinations no longer in general use, experimental DAA combinations presented at society meetings, specific discrepancies between package inserts and the AASLD published guidelines, and the potential use of sofosbuvir outside of indication in patients with certain degrees of renal disease and uncompensated cirrhosis. Dr. Jacobson, welcome to this eViral Hepatitis Review Podcast.
Thank you, Bob. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
In your newsletter issue, Doctor, you reviewed the recent studies that led to the approval of the two newest regimens for what used to be called the hard-to-treat patients with hepatitis C infection. I'm referring, of course, to sofosbuvir, velpatasvir, voxileprevir, or the soft-vel-vox regimen, and the glecaprevir-bebrentasvir regimen, or GLE-PIP, also abbreviated as GP. Our objective today is to look at how both these regimens can work most effectively in clinical practice. So start us off, if you would please, Dr. Jacobson, with a patient scenario.
Bob, I'd like to start with a 58-year-old man with hepatitis C virus genotype 1A infection, stage 2 hepatic fibrosis, who failed a course of 8 weeks of lidipasvir-sofosbuvir previously.
Doctor, why do you think this patient failed 8 weeks of lidipasvir-sofosbuvir? Was it the wrong choice of agent? Was it the wrong duration? Give us your thoughts, if you would, please.
Bob, your question gives us a good opportunity to remember that 8 weeks of lidipasvir-sofosbuvir is still a perfectly viable, fully approved regimen, as it has been for several years, in genotype 1 infected patients who were treatment naive, not even having gotten interferon prior to their initial course of therapy, who were not cirrhotic, which this patient was not with his stage 2 fibrosis, and who had baseline HCV RNA levels of less than 6 million international units per milliliter, which in fact covers about two-thirds of our HCV genotype type 1 infected population. I would just remind everybody as well that the AASLD IDSA guidance document, which is online as hcvguidelines.org, a very important reference source for all HCV treaters, went further based on several lines of evidence to suggest that only non-black patients should be treated with the 8-week regimen and that black patients should get 12 weeks, and similarly that patients with HIV co-infection should get 12 weeks rather than 8. And so there's nothing to suggest that this patient got an incorrect regimen. This was likely, provided the patient met the criteria that I've enumerated, a perfectly appropriate regimen to have received as his first exposure to direct-acting antiviral agents.
As you determine your retreatment strategy here, what effect does the patient's stage 2 fibrosis have on your treatment selection?
Well, of course, that's a very important question. The newly approved agents, newly approved as of summer of 2017, for DAA-experienced patients, which this patient now is, don't really differentiate between non-cirrhotics and cirrhotics, and I'll specify how that plays out with each of the two approved regimens, while also emphasizing at this point that the two recently approved regimens for DAA failure patients are in fact the first two approved regimens ever for that population. For several years, we've seen case reports or case series looking at existing regimens or modifications of existing regimens for DAA failure patients, but none of those were ever approved. The two newly approved regimens for DAA failure patients, and specifically this patient received an NS5A inhibitor previously, lidipasvir, of course, sofosbuvir is a nucleotide polymerase inhibitor, are as follows. The first is a triple combination incorporated into one tablet, taken once daily, of sofosbuvir, the nucleotide polymerase inhibitor, dolutegravir, a pangenotypic NS5A inhibitor, and voxelaprevir, a new protease inhibitor that had not been marketed previously for hepatitis C in any regimen, a pangenotypic HCV protease inhibitor. That triple regimen is approved for 12 weeks in patients who have previously been exposed to a DAA regimen containing an NS5A inhibitor, as lutetrasvir is. The other newly approved regimen that is approved for genotype 1 DAA failure patients is a pangenotypic regimen of a protease inhibitor called glecaprevir and an NS5A inhibitor called pibrentasvir. For patients who have previously received an NS5A inhibitor, as this patient did when he received lutetrasvir and sofosbuvir, that regimen is now approved for 16 weeks, not 12 weeks, independent of whether the patient has cirrhosis or not. And I would stipulate furthermore that this only covers, indeed, when we talk about cirrhotic patients, we're talking in general about child Pugh A cirrhotics or those with compensated cirrhosis. Let's keep in mind that no protease inhibitor for hepatitis C is currently approved for decompensated cirrhotics with child Pugh B or C disease.
With that as background, how would you treat this patient?
Well, we've mentioned already that two regimens have been recently approved as the first approved HCV treatment regimens for DAA-experienced patients, and now we're talking specifically again about a regimen that contained an NS5A inhibitor the first time around. We can talk about other types of antiviral regimens to which patients may have been exposed later, but the fact is that almost all patients who currently take HCV therapy with these direct-acting antivirals, and interferon, of course, is gone, so we're talking about all HCV-treated patients at the present time, nearly all get an NS5A inhibitor. And so when we talk about NS5A inhibitor-exposed patients, we're talking basically about nearly all or essentially all DAA-experienced patients. The two regimens, once again, are sofosbuvir, velpatasvir, voxelaprevir for 12 weeks, and glecaprevir and pibrentasvir for 16 weeks in HCV genotype 1-infected patients. The sustained virologic response rates are well over 90% with both of these regimens, but I should point out that there was a much larger database in the phase 3 trial that looked at SOF-VEL-VOX, as we abbreviate that triplet regimen, than for GP, as we abbreviate the doublet regimen that I've been talking about.
And baseline resistance testing.
Neither of these regimens is baseline resistance testing indicated, and happily for clinicians and patients everywhere, ribavirin is not indicated either.
And the actual SVR rate for the SOF-VEL-VOX regimen?
For SOF-VEL-VOX, in a now famous study called Polaris 1 that was published in the New England Journal earlier in 2017, the SVR rate in patients just like ours, a patient who had been exposed to an NS5A inhibitor previously and had virologic failure, was 96%. And if we subdivide those patients into non-cirrhotic and cirrhotic patients, it's worth pointing out that the SVR rate was 99% in the non-cirrhotic patients. Indeed, the only patient who failed was not a virologic failure, but was somebody who had to be counted as a failure, but was either lost to follow-up or discontinued, which really is not attributable to a failure of the antiviral regimen per se. In contrast, the SVR rate was 93% in cirrhotic patients. Now, our patient that we're talking about here in this scenario was non-cirrhotic, so the very high, really uniform rate of virologic success, minus the patient with non-virologic failure, is worth emphasizing as having pertained to non-cirrhotic patients like this one.
And the SVR rate for GP?
In the Magellan 1 Part 2 study, which was the main phase 3 trial that led to the approval of GP or glecaprevir pibrentasvir in genotype 1 patients who had failed a previous regimen with an NS5A inhibitor, the SVR rate was 94%. Now, the SVR rates are nearly the same, but I do want to underscore a point I made a moment ago, which is that the database was quite a bit larger in the Polaris 1 study of SOF-VEL-VOX. It contained a little over 100 patients in the active treatment arm. It was a placebo-controlled trial, but over 100 patients were treated, whereas the arm in the Magellan 1 Part 2 study of GP that attained the SVR rate of 94% had 18 patients in it, of whom 17 out of 18 had a sustained virologic response.
What can you tell us about other potential treatment regimens for prior DAA failures?
Yeah, well, for several years, we've looked at other treatment regimens because we've gotten greedy in this field. We want to cure everybody. We're not willing to settle for 2 or 3 or 4% failure rates because you have to do something for those patients, too. In other words, we want to leave no patient behind. So we've looked at regimens like 24 weeks of lenacapavir-sofosbuvir or 24 weeks of sofosbuvir-velpatavir plus ribavirin, which actually worked pretty well in a recent study presented at the AASLD meeting. And people have looked at the triplet regimen of ambitisvir, paratapravir, tisabivir, combined with a fourth element, sofosbuvir, for 12 weeks, which was great in terms of efficacy, as was a triplet regimen of elbisvir and crizapravir combined with sofosbuvir for 12 weeks. All of these presented at various meetings or published. The problem with all of them at the present time is that none of them are FDA approved, and the ones where you're combining elements from different sponsors in particular are going to be pretty expensive.
So to wrap things up on the patient you presented, what would be your specific treatment recommendation?
My answer to the question of how I would treat this particular non-cirrhotic genotype 1 patient who failed an NS5A inhibitor-containing regimen is very straightforward. Of the two recently approved regimens, I prefer the triplet regimen of sofosbuvir, velpatasvir, and voxelapravir, because it's based on a much larger data set. It's a more robust study that led to its approval. And so inevitably, I think one can say fairly that one might have more confidence in that regimen. In fact, I think the same line of reasoning was adopted by the expert panel that composes the constantly revised HCV treatment guidelines on hcvguidelines.org from the AASLD and IDSA, because they say flat out that their top line recommended regimen for patients like this is Sofvel-Vox for 12 weeks.
Well, thank you for that case and discussion, Doctor. And we'll return with Dr. Ira Jacobson from the New York University School of Medicine in just a moment. This is Bob Busker, Managing Editor of eViral Hepatitis Review. eViral Hepatitis Review is a combination newsletter and podcast program delivered via email to subscribers. Newsletters are published every other month. Each issue reviews the current literature in areas of importance to hepatologists, infectious disease specialists, primary care physicians, nurses, nurse practitioners, and other clinicians caring for patients with viral hepatitis. In the month following each newsletter, a case-based podcast discussion, like the one you're listening to now, is available to help translate that new information into clinical practice. These podcasts are also available as downloadable transcripts. Subscription to eViral Hepatitis Review is provided without charge or prerequisite. Continuing education credit for each newsletter and each podcast is provided by the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and the Institute for Johns Hopkins Nursing. For more information on this educational activity, to subscribe and receive eViral Hepatitis Review without charge, and to access back issues, please go to our website, www.eviralhepatitisreview.org. Thank you. Welcome back to this eViral Hepatitis Review podcast. We've been speaking with Dr. Ira Jacobson from the New York University School of Medicine about how patients with hepatitis C infection, who used to be classified as hard to treat, can now more likely achieve SVR with newly improved therapies. So let's continue, if you would please, Dr. Jacobson, with another patient scenario.
Let's talk about a 49-year-old woman with a genotype 3 hepatitis C infection, compensated cirrhosis, who failed a previous regimen of peg interferon and ribavirin.
Retreatment regimens available for this patient, Doctor. What would those be?
Well, there are a couple of treatment regimens that are approved, actually three. Let's remember that genotype 3, at the beginning of this exciting era of direct-acting antiviral therapy for hepatitis C, was the most challenging genotype. It responded least well to regimens that, after all, were largely constructed by medicinal chemists to cover the highly preponderant genotype 1 in the United States and many other parts of the world, although it's not true that in every part of the world is genotype 1 the predominant genotype. And as it happened, the genotype 3 regimens didn't respond particularly well to our initial, very exciting, indeed revolutionary genotype 1 regimens. Also, we found that when we introduced sofosbuvir and ribavirin as the first DEA regimen for genotype 3, that there was something about having genotype 3 and compensated cirrhosis, especially when you failed a previous course of interferon, that all worked against you and conferred very low rates of SVR. And that's led to a very exciting late development in this revolution called DEA therapy for hepatitis C, which is the advent and recent approval of pangenotypic regimens, by which we mean regimens that are capable of pretty equally covering all of the genotypes and conferring at least similarly, if not exactly the same, very high rates of sustained virologic response. The two pangenotypic regimens that we now have available and that are indeed approved for genotype 3 are the combination of sofosbuvir and vilpatasvir, the latter being an NS5A inhibitor that covers genotype 3 better than any previously approved NS5A inhibitor, and the newest regimen of GP, as we've called it earlier, or glecaprevir-pabrentasvir, where pabrentasvir and glecaprevir also cover genotype 3 very well. The pabrentasvir very potently, like vilpatasvir does, and the glecaprevir pretty much better than any previous protease inhibitor on the market had. So both of these are our approved and preferred regimens for genotype 3, although for fair and balance, I would add that a couple of years ago, the first approved regimen in some parts of the world for genotype 3 was that of the cladisvir, an older NS5A inhibitor that covers genotype 3 pretty well, combined with sofosbuvir. The short answer to your question is that for all practical purposes, the regimens that we now use for genotype 3 are either sofosbuvir-vilpatasvir, which we call SofVil for short, and glecaprevir-pabrentasvir, or GP for short.
In this patient, genotype 3 and compensated cirrhosis who previously failed PEG interferon and ribavirin, is there a role for baseline resistance testing?
Very good question, Bob. The short answer is no, and indeed that's the practical answer, and I could end it there, but I would point out that with the regimen of SofVil in its famous study called Astral 3 that looked at SofVil, if you had a resistant variant at the 93 position, generally the Y93H substitution, it's an amino acid substitution, or another one called the Y93N, you did have a somewhat adverse impact on the chance for sustained virologic response. And that was all the more so in patients who had failed interferon or I should say, who had cirrhosis. And that led to a rather complicated set of recommendations in the ASLD guidance document, wherein patients who had failed interferon previously, even if not cirrhotic, or treatment-naive cirrhotics were supposed to have a resistance test at baseline, and they recommended, contrary to the package insert, which just said SofVil, period, that you add ribavirin for those patients if they had a Y93 substitution. They further recommended, interestingly, in contrast to the package insert, that if you were a cirrhotic with previous interferon failure and genotype 3, that you should just take ribavirin, no questions asked, don't even get the resistance test. So in that sense, baseline resistance testing hasn't been recommended either in the package insert or the ASLD guidance document for these patients if you were going to use SofVil ever since it was approved in 2016. With GP, there is no recommendation for baseline resistance testing, nor has the suggestion ever been made. So the short answer is no. Some of us still, at least until recently, did continue to get baseline resistance testing so we can decide in whom to use ribavirin when we use SofVil. Now, the ASLD guidance document did take it a step further in their very last guidelines by saying that in these particular patients with both interferon failure and a history of interferon ribavirin failure, go ahead and use SofVil Vox, really instead of SofVil and ribavirin, although you could use that as an alternative. And that's very interesting because there is no approval for SofVil Vox in anybody except DA experienced patients in the package insert for that product. Interesting divergence here between the FDA approval language for that regimen of SofVil Vox and what the expert panel says in its guidance document. And as a final addendum to that answer, Bob, I would say that in genotype 3 patients who have compensated cirrhosis and have previously taken interferon, that a regimen of 16 weeks of GP is recommended as opposed to 12 weeks.
For this patient, doctor, what other management measures are indicated?
I think that's really an important question because we talk about SVR rate and recommended regimens and not recommended regimens and resistant variants all the time, but there's also a patient who needs to be taken care of in his or her totality. Most importantly, in a cirrhotic patient like this one, we have to remember to screen for liver cancer, hepatocellular carcinoma, or HCC, every 6 months with one or another imaging modality. And I think a discussion of precisely which imaging modality to use at various time points is beyond our scope. Suffice it to say that sonography is considered the standard, but plenty of us resort to CT or, from my point of view, even better yet, MRI, sometimes in the event of obesity or difficulty seeing the liver under ultrasound. The important thing is every 6-month imaging. And equally important is the admonition that that screening must continue in patients with pre-existing cirrhosis or advanced fibrosis beyond the point at which virologic cure has occurred, because we do recognize that although happily the risk of liver cancer goes down by about 80% in cured patients, it doesn't disappear. And so there's a common consensus amongst most experts nowadays that screening for liver cancer must continue indefinitely, even if one accumulates evidence from clinical observation or non-invasive tests for fibrosis that the cirrhosis may have regressed. The second of the 3 points that I'd like to mention with regard to management measures is with regard to esophageal varices. For patients who didn't have varices at baseline, and let's remember that all cirrhotics should be screened for varices, so one can apply preemptive measures to prevent variceal bleeding for the first time, or of course treat varices if bleeding has occurred previously, is to scope the patient at least one more time after virologic cure to make sure there are no new varices. And then I don't think you have to keep doing it, but if varices were present, particularly if they required treatment previously, you do have to keep managing those varices with whatever modality, including endoscopy and band ligation and or beta blockade that you may have instituted previously. And the third management measure is to continue to encourage abstinence from alcohol or at least significant amounts of alcohol in patients who had a lot of scar tissue or cirrhosis in their livers beforehand, with the possibility perhaps of greater flexibility as time goes by if you do accumulate evidence of regression of cirrhosis. But even then, we have to really discourage people who've been heavy alcohol consumers in the past from drinking again.
Well, thank you, Dr. Jacobson. Now, we've got time for one more patient scenario, so if you would, please.
Let's talk about a 76-year-old man with renal failure on hemodialysis with HCV genotype 1B and stage 3 fibrosis on elastography.
Renal failure and on dialysis. These patients have always been considered especially challenging. What are the current treatment recommendations?
For a genotype 1 patient with renal failure, there are 2 recommended treatment options, and what they share in common is that they don't contain sofosbuvir, the nucleotide polymerase inhibitor that has done so much to help revolutionize the treatment of hepatitis C, but which has the liability, if it can be called that, of being excreted predominantly through the kidneys. And so the metabolite of sofosbuvir has demonstrated early in its development already, accumulates considerably to as much as 20-fold in patients with renal failure with potential safety concerns. And so the answer to your question is that the 2 recommended treatment options for this patient with genotype 1 are the combination of elbisvir and grazoprevir for 12 weeks or glecaprevir-pibrentasvir for 8 weeks. The latter regimen, glecaprevir-pibrentasvir, is approved across all genotypes, but the elbisvir-crizoprevir is approved for genotypes 1 and 4.
Can a sofosbuvir-based regimen be used at all for patients like this?
Yes, but there's an important difference between what can be used and what's approved. There are, in fact, a number of case series from different investigators looking at variable numbers of patients with renal failure who've been given either the standard or lower doses of sofosbuvir, lower doses in certain series just to be on the safe side, and there actually have been no safety concerns despite the known accumulation of the major metabolite of sofosbuvir, which I can always remember because the last 3 numbers of that metabolite are 007, and I was always a James Bond fan. Sofosbuvir itself doesn't accumulate because it's metabolized quite quickly, so that's not the concern. But anytime the metabolite of a drug accumulates as many-fold as this one does, there are potential safety concerns that have not materialized in those clinical case series. At the end of the day, however, the approval language for sofosbuvir still stipulates that it's approved only for patients with GFRs, or glomerular filtration rates, of 30 milliliters per minute and above. It is not approved for patients with lesser degrees of renal function than a GFR of 30 mils per minute. In contrast, the protease and NS5A inhibitors that I've mentioned are approved, for example, for patients with renal failure, are all excreted by the hepatobiliary route, not by the renal route, and so you don't have these pharmacokinetic concerns. And there have been no distinctive safety issues that have arisen in this population of renal patients when those 2 regimens have been used.
Just for clarity, doctor, are there any instances where you might use a sofosbuvir-based regimen in a patient with renal failure?
The answer is hardly ever would I use a SOF-based regimen in a patient with renal failure, but there is one situation where you're a little bit between a rock and a hard place, and those are patients with decompensated cirrhosis and renal failure. Now, let's remember, as we said earlier in the program, that you're not supposed to use protease inhibitors in patients with decompensated cirrhosis because they and their metabolites potentially do accumulate in patients with advanced liver disease because they do get excreted through the hepatobiliary route. And in fact, there have been concerns that that may have resulted in some safety issues in that population. And the FDA approvals for all of the protease inhibitors stipulate that they're either not recommended or contraindicated in patients with decompensated cirrhosis. That's the rock. The hard place is that you're not supposed to use sofosbuvir in renal failure. So if you have a patient with decompensated cirrhosis and renal failure, and you still want to treat the patient, and there certainly are instances when we'd like to do that, you have to choose one or the other. And in light of the data, albeit case series rather than any pivotal trial that's been incorporated into approval language for a sofosbuvir-containing product, I would go with the sofosbuvir in renal failure and feel more comfortable with that rather than with a protease inhibitor and decompensated cirrhotic. And so the answer is I would use a sofosbuvir-based regimen in a patient with renal failure if they have decompensated cirrhosis and if we think that they should now receive a course of antiviral therapy. And Bob, it is very important to stress that the comments that I've just made do involve off-label use of either of the sets of drugs that I've been talking about, whether you use protease inhibitors and decompensated cirrhotics, which I've said specifically that I wouldn't use, or sofosbuvir in patients with renal failure, which I did say I might use in selected situations, but then you have to realize that it's off-label and not approved.
Thank you for that caveat, Doctor, and also for today's cases and discussion. Let's wrap things up now by reviewing what we've talked about in light of our learning objectives. So to begin, clinical considerations when selecting a retreatment regimen for patients who have failed previous therapy with DAA agents.
So Bob, I'm going to answer that question in the context of patients who have failed previous therapy with DAA agents that contained an NS5A inhibitor, because as I've emphasized earlier, nearly all patients who have taken DAA regimens, especially in the last couple of years, and this is still true on an ongoing basis, have taken an NS5A inhibitor as part of their regimen. And again, we have two recently approved regimens that represent the first two approved regimens, FDA-approved regimens, for patients who have failed an NS5A inhibitor containing regimen of DAA therapy. And those are sofosbuvir, vilpatasvir, voxelaprevir for 12 weeks or glecaprevir, pibrentasvir for 16 weeks. Either is acceptable, but I think for some clinical experts, including, I would have to say, the experts who write the guidelines for the ASLD guidance document, give preferred status to the 12-week regimen of sof-vil-vox, mostly because the trials on which these two approvals were based were much larger. Specifically, the Polaris-1 trial with sof-vil-vox was much larger than the trial and therefore the data set on which the approval of GP in this population is based. Still in all, both have conferred SVR rates well over 90% in this population, and both have to be considered acceptable.
And our second learning objective, the clinical considerations when selecting a retreatment option for patients who have failed previous therapy with PEG interferon and ribavirin or who are treatment naive.
Bob, the overarching consideration when selecting a regimen for either treatment-naive patients or a treatment regimen for patients who failed previous therapy with PEG interferon and ribavirin is that there are several excellent choices. In fact, there are at least four that are listed in the ASLD guidance document at hcvguidelines.org that are all top-line recommended regimens, and they are top-line because they have similar or equivalent very high degrees of efficacy in attaining sustained virologic response. So the nuances are things like potential drug-drug interactions that one regimen might have with a drug the patient happens to be on, whereas another regimen might fit a little better, whether the patient is on higher doses of proton pump inhibitors and can't stop them because of gastroesophageal reflux disease, because we have to remember that high doses of PPIs do impair the absorption of ledipizivir and vilpatasvir. Sometimes it just gets down to which regimen the payer prefers. And as long as you don't feel that you're compromising the patient's chance of sustained virologic response, I think that's a reasonable consideration. For patients in whom the clinician feels that duration is an overarching priority, which I think is usually generally not the case, but it's nice to be shorter if you can. We do have a newly approved pangenotypic regimen of glecaprevir-pabrentasvir that is approved for 8 weeks in treatment-naive non-cirrhotics across genotypes 1 through 6. And we also have to remember that lutetavir-sofosbuvir is still approved for 8 weeks in genotype 1 non-cirrhotics who are treatment-naive and have baseline viral levels below 6 million IU per mil. At the end of the day, you don't want to use a regimen that has ribavirin if you don't have to. And I think that would be the last of the considerations that I would underscore here.
And finally, considerations when selecting treatment regimens for patients with renal impairment.
For patients with renal impairment, let's remember that sofosbuvir is not approved for patients with GFRs less than 30 mils per minute because it does depend almost entirely on renal excretion, and its major metabolite can accumulate manyfold when you use it in such patients, whereas we do have two approved regimens now of elbisvir-grazoprevir and glecaprevir-pabrentasvir, the latter of which is pangenotypic, that avoid that issue and that have achieved extremely high levels of both efficacy and safety in their clinical trials, which constitutes the basis of their approval. And for me, in my practice, those are the two regimens that you should consider in any patient with renal impairment who's going to be treated for hepatitis C.
Dr. Ira Jacobson from the New York University School of Medicine, thank you for participating in this eViral Hepatitis Review podcast.
Bob, it's been a great pleasure to participate in this program, and I appreciate the opportunity.
To receive CME credit for this activity, please take the post-test at www.eviralhepatitisreview.org/test. This podcast is presented in conjunction with the eViral Hepatitis Review newsletter, a peer-reviewed literature review certified for CME CE credit, emailed monthly to clinicians treating patients with viral hepatitis. This activity has been developed for primary care physicians, gastroenterologists, infectious disease specialists, OBGYNs, physician assistants, nurse practitioners and nurses, and other clinicians diagnosing or managing patients with viral hepatitis. This activity has been planned and implemented in accordance with the accreditation requirements and policies of the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, ACCME, through the joint providership of the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and the Institute for Johns Hopkins Nursing. The Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine is accredited by the ACCME to provide continuing medical education for physicians. The Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine designates this enduring material for a maximum of 0.5 AMA PRA Category 1 credits. Physicians should claim only the credit commensurate with the extent of their participation in this activity. The Institute for Johns Hopkins Nursing is accredited as a provider of continuing nursing education by the American Nurses Credentialing Center's Commission on Accreditation. This 0.5 contact hour educational activity is provided by the Institute for Johns Hopkins Nursing. Each podcast carries a maximum of 0.5 contact hour. This educational resource is provided without charge, but registration is required. To register to receive eViral Hepatitis Review via email, please go to our website, www.eviralhepatitisreview.org. The opinions and recommendations expressed by faculty and other experts whose input is included in this program are their own. This enduring material is produced for educational purposes only. Use of the names of the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and the Institute for Johns Hopkins Nursing implies review of educational format, design, and approach. Please review the complete prescribing information for specific drugs, combinations of drugs, or use of medical equipment, including indication, contraindications, warnings, and adverse effects, before administering therapy to patients. eViral Hepatitis Review is supported by educational grants from Gilead Sciences Incorporated, Merck & Company Incorporated, and AbbVie Incorporated. This program is copyright, with all rights reserved, by the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and the Institute for Johns Hopkins Nursing.